I've got clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, and here you are stuck in the middle with me.
Hey, Saturday Night Live stealing my gig. What's
well,
up with that?
I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast. As heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM Queso in Cozy Cottage Grove. Out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster. Out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. Up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And coast to coast and blanketing the globe. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. You can run, but you can't hide from the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Glad you could join us for another thrilling action-packed adventure. Coming up, the Democratic presidential nominees faced off over the weekend in Flint, Michigan, in the town facing a catastrophic lead poisoning crisis thanks to the Republican state government there. That'll be the first of two Democratic debates that will be held this week. We will talk about that one with two Michigan residents shortly. But first, if you weren't paying attention, there were a bunch of nominating contests held over the weekend on both the Democratic and Republican sides. The bulk of them on what is being called Super Saturday. And the results were both interesting and counter to the prevailing conventional wisdom that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are sailing to the nomination in their respective parties. Yes, Bernie Sanders and, yes, Ted Cruz both won the weekend. Had you heard? First, on the on the Republican side, in Kansas, the caucus in Kansas, Ted Cruz won big, 25 points over Donald Trump in the state of Kansas. In Maine, Ted Cruz also won big, 13 points over Donald Trump. In Kentucky, also a caucus, Trump did win. He beat Ted Cruz, but it was much closer by just 4 points. And in Louisiana, where they did hold a primary, not a caucus, Donald Trump won over Ted Cruz, at least reportedly. And that one was very close as well. 3.5 points over Ted Cruz. So officially on Super Saturday, Ted Cruz won two nominating contests. Trump won two nominating contests. And, on Super Saturday, party savior Marco Rubio won absolutely nothing. But he did sweep Puerto Rico on Sunday, so there's that. The Super Saturday delegate count was 69 delegates for Ted Cruz, just 53 for Donald Trump. So Ted Cruz won the weekend delegate count. Now Trump is still up, he's still ahead, but not by all that much. Trump has 384 delegates to Ted Cruz's 300. Then Marco Rubio is far behind with 151. And then John Kasich is still in the race with just 37 delegates so far. But this could turn out to be a race. The funny thing, however, happened Saturday in Louisiana. Donald Trump As soon as the polls closed in Louisiana, Donald Trump was immediately announced the big winner based on the release of early absentee votes that were counted in advance. Absentee ballots are cast on paper. All the networks and AP, et cetera, called it immediately for Donald Trump, declaring a landslide win for him in Louisiana. And then, as the night went on, as they actually started tabulating Election Day votes, those votes that were actually cast on Election Day, and the margin between Trump and Ted Cruz kept getting smaller and smaller, to the point that folks like Nate Silver over at 538.com and other people who watch these results really closely, suddenly they all thought that the networks made a big mistake, that they should be retracting their call for Donald Trump because it looked like Ted Cruz could overtake him based on Election Day votes, which Ted Cruz was winning big time. Remember, when they call these races, when you hear that AP has called the race or CNN has called the race, it's not based on actual vote counts. It's based on stuff like exit polls and sometimes absentee ballots that have been counted in advance, early voting, absentee, and so forth. It's not based on actual vote counts. And then when you do get those numbers, those counts are not actually based on people counting paper ballots. They're based on whatever the computers told them the paper ballots said. Now, as the margin on Saturday in Louisiana on the Republican side got smaller and smaller, it became clear that according to the early and absentee votes cast on paper and tallied in advance of Election Day, Trump was, in fact, the huge winner by about 25 points. But according to the Election Day votes, only Cruz was the winner. So that raises two really interesting questions, at least to me. One, did the GOP debate last Thursday night, the insane GOP debate and the ensuing panic from Republicans that Donald Trump was on a glide path to becoming their nominee, did that change the outlook for GOP voters? It appears that it might have, because a lot more of them now seem to be voting for Ted Cruz. So good luck with that, Republicans. It may mean, however, that neither Cruz nor Trump nor Rubio nor anyone else gets enough delegates to become the nominee on the first ballot with a majority of the delegates. And if that happens, that whole convention is up for grabs. Anything can happen. All the pledged delegates are released from their pledges and they can vote for whoever they want, even if it's someone who hasn't been in the race up till now, like Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan. As I should note, my father was the first to point out to me some weeks ago, maybe months ago at this point, that Paul Ryan could ride in and be the party's savior once again. We'll see. Number two, the bigger issue to me, much bigger issue, frankly. A very real question arose on Saturday as the results were narrowing as to whether we would ever actually know who won the Louisiana primary. Since the entire state votes on Election Day on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems made by a company that is now out of business. It's called Sequoia. They were purchased by a Canadian company called Dominion. The entire state still votes on those 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems. So who knows how people actually voted on Election Day in Louisiana? We don't. All we can go on is these unverifiable voting machines, which maybe accurately reflect the will of the voters, maybe they don't. But now, here's the thing about those specific unverifiable touchscreen voting machines that were used across the state of Louisiana on Election Day. Those are also used, by the way, across the swing state of Nevada and elsewhere. Still around this country, such as Illinois, still uses Chicago uses the Sequoia touchscreen edge voting system, for example. And in Chicago, Illinois has its primary coming up for both Democrats and Republicans on March 15th with a ton of delegates available there. In any event, aside from being unverifiable, the Sequoia touchscreen machines, which, you know, we're unable to know if Louisianans actually preferred Cruz over Trump or vice versa, but those Sequoia touchscreen voting machines also have, as bradblog.com broke exclusively back in November of 2006. And you can still go look it up, Go to bradblog.com, look for, search for the words yellow button. These Sequoia machines have a little yellow button on the back that can be pressed in such a way that, as we detailed back in 2006, 10 years ago, and as a longtime pole worker who was trained others to use those machines in out here in California back when we used to use the same ones, as he explained to me at the time, you can press this button in such a way that you can then vote as many times as you want on that machine. And quote, you won't ever have to stop until someone physically restrains you from voting. Those were the machines that were used across the state of Louisiana on Saturday. Machines that have a little yellow button. They're going to be used again in Chicago that can be pressed in a specific way. And we detail the way to do it at bradblog.com so that you can vote as many times as you want until you are physically restrained. So, yeah, that's what we're still using in this country, incredibly enough. And the Republicans decided the Republican race. Remember, a Republican Party that likes to pretend that there is massive voter fraud going on, people voting more than once, etc. Now, at the time that we broke that story at BradBlog back in 2006, that yellow button issue was confirmed out here in California by the office of then Republican Secretary of State Bruce McPherson. Those Sequoia touchscreen edge machines were subsequently decertified for use in the state of California by the Democratic Secretary of State who won the election out here that year. We no longer use them out here, but Louisiana still hates its voters enough that they still do so. So who actually won the Republican primary in Louisiana on Super Tuesday? Well, officially, it was Donald Trump, but based on the unverifiable machines who say that he won by a hair, pardon the pun. But nobody actually knows. And if Ted Cruz wanted to make sure that, you know, he might have actually won on Election Day and in total in Louisiana, if he wanted to find out by challenging the reported results to do a recount or something like that, he would have almost no way of ever knowing. I should say he would have no way of ever knowing whether he actually won or lost in Louisiana. Now, you may not care. You may not care when it's a question of, you know, Trump versus Cruz, but I suspect you do care if it's a question of Sanders versus Clinton or Clinton versus Trump or Cruz in the fall. You should care. So is this any way to run a supposed democracy? And by the way, when will Republicans or Democrats start giving a damn about this issue? That story, I broke that 10 years ago, and they're still using the same machines that you can vote multiple times on. And even if you don't know if the reported results actually reflect the intent of the voters. So, you know, when will it get fixed? I suspect it's only when a huge election hangs in the balance and we're all looking at another mess like the one that we saw in 2000 in Florida. Or perhaps more accurately, when a Republican gets screwed really hard by one of these machines in one of these contests that ends up going to a Democrat, then they'll take action. Speaking of Democrats, let's look at that. How'd that go over the weekend? Well, in Louisiana, once again, where there is 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems across the state, Hillary Clinton won, and she won big, according to those reported results, by 48 points. Not a complete surprise and not much of a question. Bernie Sanders wasn't really trying down there in the state of Louisiana. So did she actually win by 48? We don't know. But she most likely won that primary. The caucuses, however, were a different matter. Bernie Sanders won the Kansas state caucus. He won it big by 36 points with record turnout by the Democrats in the state of Kansas. Something that Bernie Sanders has been arguing, that he can get out larger numbers of people. Well, maybe there's finally some evidence for that in the state of Kansas. In Nebraska, the caucus there, Bernie Sanders also won with a pretty healthy margin, 14 points over Hillary Clinton. In Maine, Bernie Sanders also won. It was a landslide in Maine. That was on Sunday, actually. A huge turnout. He reportedly won by 29 points. In the state of Maine, where they had such huge crowds, they were overwhelmed, according to Democrats, were overwhelmed by the turnout in Portland and elsewhere around the state, according to WMTW News in Portland. They said that the line to get inside of the Deering High School caucus in Portland, for example, stretched around the athletic fields. Some estimated the line to get inside the school was at least a half mile long. The process was moved outside to ease congestion inside the school. One of the organizers there said it's sort of survival of the fittest. I think about all the people with, actually, this wasn't an organizer. This was somebody waiting in line. Said, I think about all the people with young kids who got online that clearly can't still be online. Elderly people who are wrapped around the block. So it's sad there wasn't better foresight of this. Yeah, you think? One man said he had been in line for 3 hours and still hadn't voted. Two told WMTW that they waited in line for 5 hours to vote. At one point, the crowd was doing the wave to pass the time, reportedly. Much of the enthusiasm in the line appeared to be for Sanders, who told his supporters over the past week in Portland that he will win if there is a large turnout. Well, there was a large turnout, and enough people were able to stick around in line long enough for Bernie Sanders to win in a landslide, 29 points. So Bernie Sanders, not Hillary Clinton, but Bernie Sanders not only won 3 out of 4 nominating contests over the past weekend, but he also beat her in delegates. Bernie Sanders, and you wouldn't know this from watching, you know, CNN or reading the mainstream media, Bernie Sanders won 67 delegates over the weekend. Hillary won just 64. She's still beating him in total voted delegates, in total pledged delegates, but not by a lot. 600 got 658, he's got 471. But most of the mainstream media, as we've been reporting, has been including the so-called superdelegates, the party insiders and elected officials who haven't actually cast their vote. They don't vote until the convention. So as far as real voted delegates go, it's pretty close. Hillary leads by just 187. Well, 166 delegates are up for grabs in Michigan and Mississippi alone this Tuesday. And well over 600 delegates are up for grabs the Tuesday after that. So there's 187 delegate margin here. That's it. 130 delegates alone are up for grabs in Michigan on Tuesday. And so the Democrats held a debate on Sunday in Flint, Michigan, a town, as I noted, that is at the epicenter of a massive lead poisoning crisis caused by the state's Republican government and Republican governor. And that is what we will discuss next. That debate in Michigan, in Flint, Michigan. Next, we will discuss it with two Michiganders right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
Excuse me, I'm talking.
Let him sprung.
If you're going to talk, tell the whole story, Senator
Let
Sanders.
Me tell my story, you tell yours.
I will.
Let's get it on.
Yes, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The Democratic presidential candidates got it on over the weekend in Flint, Michigan. I'm sorry I said that. I have just seen something in my brain that I cannot unsee. My apologies to listeners. Let's say they squared off on Sunday in Flint, Michigan. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders did. In Flint, where the city is still contending with the disastrous toxic lead poisoning crisis in their drinking water, brought on by the state's Republican governor, Rick Snyder, and his appointment of a so-called emergency manager in Flint, who, in addition to usurping the powers of the locally elected government, approved a switch from drinking water from the Detroit water system to drinking water from the Flint River, which corroded pipes and permanently poisoned untold thousands of people, including children, who will now face neurological and other problems for the rest of their lives. Here's how Anderson Cooper explained it at the top of the debate on CNN on Sunday night.
This is a city in crisis, a city where, as you probably know, the tap water is toxic. Public servants, public institutions not only failed to prevent the crisis, their decisions created this crisis. The state of Michigan, in an effort to save money, switched Flint's water source to a cheaper but riskier alternative, the Flint River. Safeguards were ignored. That river water corroded residential pipes, and for nearly 2 years, lead leaked into the water used in people's homes. Now, for much of that time, the state downplayed the danger, even in the face of growing complaints and physical evidence. For 100 days, the federal government knew about it, and yet, in all that time, nobody told the people of Flint. They bathed in the water, they drank it, and so did their kids. Even today, lead is still present in some of the water.
That was Anderson Cooper introducing the Democratic debate in Flint, Michigan on Sunday night. And just as we go to air here today, a lawsuit stemming from Flint's lead-contaminated water was filed on behalf of the city's residents against Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, as well as other current and former government officials and corporations, according to AP. This latest lawsuit, which seeks a jury trial and unspecified damages, was filed on behalf of seven residents. As well, a second recall petition has now been filed by a Flint activist naming Snyder. While referencing the water crisis, that was approved. That second recall petition was approved on Monday by the Board of State Canvassers, according to the Detroit Free Press. It was an extraordinary debate, I think, on Sunday night, in that I can't think of another one like it, frankly, where so much of a presidential debate was devoted to one single important local issue directly in the town that was affected by it. Several weeks ago, after the national media finally began to notice the disaster in Flint, we were joined here on the broadcast by Flint resident, father, and novelist Connor Coyne to discuss what he had felt the national media had been getting wrong in their coverage of the crisis in Flint, specifically by ignoring the devastating impact of the emergency manager system that had been imposed on them by Governor Snyder, not just in Flint, but also in other cities around Michigan. This was after voters had actually voted to end the state's emergency management system, the emergency manager law, by a state referendum in 2012. But immediately that law was reinstituted at the state capitol in a way that it could not be voted down again by the people in a state referendum. I thought it would be a good idea to have two guests here today, both from Michigan. First, I thought it would be good to have Connor Coyne back following Sunday night's Democratic debate. Connor, as I said, is a writer, novelist, and stay-at-home dad from Flint, Michigan. His website is at ConnorCoyne.com. Hey, Connor, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I really appreciate you coming back. Now, as I recall, you have two young daughters, and happily, you had helped to keep them safe early on, as you told me last time you were on the show, by installing filters on your taps early in the crisis and so forth. How are they and you doing out there in Flint at this point?
I mean, as far as we know, they're doing fine. We are not aware of them having had any ill effects. It still is stressful. I mean, everything's stressful. One of the things which has been kind of going around recently is people who had their water tested, and it tested very low for lead, as did our house, have gotten subsequent tests, and it's shown fluctuations. So in some cases, households where lead was at an acceptable level, it is now higher in those homes. And this has been over the last couple months. So now we're sort of concerned about that. But as far as we know, they're okay, and they haven't had any ill effects. And, you know, like every parent in the city, we're just going to keep doing what we have to do and keep an eye on the situation.
Wow, what a perilous and horrible way to live. Joining us also is fellow Michigander Marcy Wheeler. She is an independent journalist covering legal issues around national security, civil liberties, and presidential politics. She's been a contributor to The Guardian, Salon, The Intercept, and can and should be read at emptywheel.net and on the Twitters at emptywheel. Hey, Marcy Wheeler, welcome back to the broadcast.
good to be back.
It's been too long, so I'm glad you're here. Very quickly now, just for transparency's sake, for this point of this debate discussion, Marcy, are you currently working for or leaning towards any of the candidates, Democratic, Republican, or otherwise at this point?
I am not working for at all. I prefer Sanders in the primary, but I think Hillary is going to be better than a Republican, and I expect she'll win the nomination. So.
And Connor Coyne, are you working or leaning towards any particular candidate?
I'm not working for either candidate. Actually, Marcy summed up my my views relatively well. I think that this year the Democratic Party is benefiting from two extraordinary candidates, and that this competition between them has made them both better. And so so I'm voting for Sanders, but I will be happy to vote for Clinton in November should she get the nomination.
And in fact, the state of Michigan is voting on Tuesday with a lot of delegates at stake there. Before we get to the CNN Democratic debate, you guys, the one in Flint, there was an insane Republican debate sponsored by Fox News last Thursday down in Detroit. I very quickly wanted to get thoughts from each of you from a Michigan perspective on that debate. There was just one question to one candidate, as I recall, I think it was to Marco Rubio about the Flint disaster. Nothing at all on what I think is the most outrageous aspect in truth, this entire emergency manager law, this really ultimate big government tyranny that Republicans pretend to be against, where, you know, you just the governor can replace anyone he wants, any elected officials he wants, with any one of his choosing. So very quickly, what were your thoughts on the Michigan aspects of that debate held in Detroit, after all, which, you know, also has had emergency managers appointed there by the governor? Marcy Wheeler, any thoughts on that from a Michigan perspective?
Yeah, I think Rubio spent an entirety of about 45 seconds responding to the Flint question. There was another question, I think, to maybe Kasich on Detroit's schools, which, as you said, were also put under an emergency manager. But if you compare the Flint response from Rubio to his probably two-minute Benghazi response later in the debate, it really makes it clear the degree to which Republicans... I mean, look, Snyder is dead weight around the Republicans' neck, and I think that, you know, he hasn't endorsed anyone. I think because nobody wants his endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
Even within the state, there are increasing numbers of Republicans who admit that ultimately this was his screw up. I mean, he promised competence and delivered poison.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And Connor, did were you surprised that there was not more on Flint in that Republican debate? I mean, it was in Detroit, after all. We know that Fox News and Republicans don't like to talk about this because, you know, they have to blame their own party. But were you surprised it didn't come up more in that debate?
No, not really. At the risk of being blunt, it's been, I think, decades since the Republican Party has really been interested in Flint in any capacity other than you know, a nuisance that they have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't particularly surprised by Rubio's response either. Neither its brevity or it's kind of out of touch with the problem. You know, one of the things he said, sort of, I believe at the tail end of that statement, was that he was that it should not be politicized,
right.
Which is, of course, something that many Republicans have said, not so much in defense of Governor Snyder per se, but perhaps to put distance between themselves and the problem. And I kind of always come back at that with, you know, I catch my daughter with crayons coloring on the wall, and I say, "What is this?" And she says, "Dad, let's not politicize this. Let's focus on solutions."
I like your daughter already. To be fair, at the Democratic debate, there was also not a lot of time. And this is the one in Flint on Sunday. There was not a lot of time spent, unfortunately, on the emergency manager law either. A good portion was spent on the specifics of the Flint crisis and others around the state, but not on the law itself. Hillary Clinton, however, she did address it at one point during one of her answers related to the crumbling Detroit school system, the facilities there, which have also now been put under the control of an emergency manager. Here was Hillary Clinton bringing this up on Sunday.
I would use every legal means at my disposal to try to force the governor and the state to return the schools to the people of Detroit, to end the emergency management. If you look at the data, the situation has only gotten worse with these emergency managers that have put the system further in debt.
Connor Coyne, was there enough focus? Well, we'll talk about the specific Flint crisis in a moment, but was there enough focus even in this debate in Flint of all places? You know, where they did go into the details, obviously, of the water crisis, but not the Michigan's emergency manager system itself. Were you satisfied with the amount of time spent on that?
Well, I wasn't satisfied. It wasn't ideal. I do wish that they had talked more about emergency management, partly just because I think it's a pernicious strategy to try and fix a local problem.
Mm-hmm.
It really has more to do with sort of stripping power away from localities than it really does with solving structural financial problems, which is, of course, the big excuse for having those laws in the first place. That being said, I can kind of see why the focus was a little bit more on the water crisis specifically from the candidates' perspective, because they would have been essentially in agreement on repealing the emergency manager law.
Yeah.
So I do wish it had gotten more, because I feel like the public perception and the public pressure to demand accountability hinges a whole lot on understanding the role that the emergency management law played in the fact that this crisis happened in the first place. But I guess I wasn't surprised that level of emphasis did not happen at a debate between two Democratic candidates.
Marcy Wheeler, you currently call Grand Rapids home, so not in Flint, but not far away in Michigan. How do the Republicans in the state who pretend to be against big government, how do they justify the use of such an undemocratic system, an undemocratic law as the emergency management law? And how do Democrats let them get away with it at this point for so many years? I mean, why aren't it just millions marching in the streets at this point?
Well, one of the dirty little secrets about the emergency manager law is that it was first instituted under Governor Blanchard back in the 80s. And Granholm used it with many of the same cities who then got re-upped into emergency management under Snyder. The difference is that Snyder made the law much more onerous in that these appointed managers with usually no expertise in governance could get rid of contracts, could basically take over the entire city. So the underlying reason why Michigan has emergency managers is one, because it's a very segregated place. Grand Rapids is one of the least diverse cities. It's the second biggest city in the state. It's one of the least diverse. It's also where DeVos lives and where the big Republican money in the state is. Nothing like that would ever happen in Grand Rapids, even though we suffer from some of the same big city problems. And the reason is race, really. And when
Rick Snyder, the governor there.
Dick DeVos is one of the GOP's biggest fundraisers in the country, and Amway was founded here. They are big donors in the city.
Mm-hmm.
They're very big on things like quote unquote school choice. They'd like to privatize a lot of the government. But what happened in the 80s is that as globalization really hit Michigan badly, began to. And you had these predominantly African-American cities and white flight and white suburbs. One way to deal with that, I mean, what you should have done, what Michigan should have done at that point was say, we're a region, we're a state, we're going to share money, we're going to live or die together, we're going to find a way out of the challenges presented to our state by globalization together. But because of the underlying racism that has existed in Michigan for a very long time, and you'll see Trump win by big numbers because of it, no one wanted to do that. No one wanted to ask white suburbanites to chip. I mean, Detroit is kind of crazy that, like, everyone in Detroit suburbs loves the Detroit Institute of Art and its sports facilities, and they go in and use them. But the notion that you would pay for a Detroit school child as opposed to a museum was anathema to all the same rich suburbanites who wouldn't kind of chip in. And so that's the underlying problem, and that we have big Republican money that is invested in disinvesting from government.
And of course, it has been the cities around the state that are majority African American that have been have had emergency managers appointed there by the governor. Both candidates called for Rick Snyder to resign from office, the governor there. It was the first time that Hillary had done so. And they both described how they would handle the problem as president. Here's Hillary Clinton on that question.
Well, I support what President Obama is doing. He called for and got accountability from officials at the EPA, who should have done more to make sure the state was doing its job. He has expanded Medicaid to begin the process of helping kids particularly get the health care they need. He's also ordered that there be a Head Start program. I support that. When it comes to the water itself, we are supporting a program that Mayor Weaver announced today, Flint Water Works, to actually pay people in Flint, not outsiders, people here, to deliver the water while we're fixing the pipes.
And here was Bernie Sanders responding to that same question about what he would do as president and frankly, what the president should be doing now.
What is going on is a disgrace beyond belief. If local government does not have the resources, if state government, for whatever reason, refuses to act, children in America should not be poisoned. Federal government comes in, federal government acts. What is absolutely incredible to me is that water rates have soared in Flint. You are paying three times more for poison water that I'm paying in Burlington, Vermont, for clean water. First thing you do is you say people are not paying a water bill for poison water. And that is retroactive. Second of all, to ease anxiety, CDC has got to come in here and examine every child and adult in this community in terms of the amount of lead they may have.
That was Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton at the Sunday debate on CNN in Flint, Michigan. Connor Coyne, as a Flint native there, and after watching all that has gone on over the past year or two, after the state came in and took over and caused this problem, would the people of Flint now welcome the feds coming in and taking things over themselves, or would you prefer to see all of this turn back to local control, as you know, to the elected officials in Flint, as it frankly should have been in the first place?
Oh wow, that's a question with a lot of different layers to it. But I think on the in terms of the response to crisis, I think there's been a very strong sense among almost all Flint residents I know, including myself, that the problems that this city is facing, including the water crisis, and the water crisis is the most urgent example, but but certainly not limited to it, are beyond the capacity of local leadership to address. We really need federal aid in order to stabilize the city. And we have, like every city around the country, we, you know, have local leaders who have done a very good job, and we're very proud of them. And we've had local leaders that we've been very disappointed in. But you could be like, you know, the brainchild of Einstein, Gandhi, and FDR, and be elected to a local position in Flint, and you would not be able to solve Flint's problems because they are so structurally entrenched, and kind of like Marcy had, you know, referenced a little bit ago, are the result of systemic racism and economic practices that go back for generations. So in terms of fixing the lead pipes, in terms of testing children, in terms of demanding accountability from the state government, in terms of, like, you know, comprehensive investigation that will ensure that this sort of thing never happens again, I think everybody in Flint that I know welcomes federal intervention. But see, I think that's a fundamentally different kind of intervention than what we've seen under the emergency managers. Because again, the emergency managers stripped the city of its autonomy and its ability to solve its own problems.
Marcy, what's the holdup right now with the feds doing exactly what both candidates seem to want, taking a more aggressive role in Flint? Why is that not happening under Obama at this point?
Well, one of the problems is that normally you would get an emergency declaration and get funds accorded through that. But because this is not a natural emergency, it's a Governor Snyder-caused emergency, Obama would either have to kind of do that on his own, which would get him in trouble with the GOP legislature and Congress, or he'd have to pass law to say, in this case, you know, granted it wasn't a flood that caused this disaster, it was instead human error on the part of Michigan. So that's one problem. But I also think there are two other ways the feds really do need to be involved, and one is the EPA standards, both for water testing and CDC funds for tracking lead exposure, the standards need to be bumped up. They need to be ensured so that other cities doesn't happen to Flint, and so that as Flint continues to test, they're actually getting good numbers. CDC, the number for lead abatement has kind of been backed off because of Republicans. That should be reversed, and we should put pressure on the feds to do that. But really importantly, and this is something that Sanders raised last night, is that, you know, the civil engineers say we need something like $3 trillion of investment to get our infrastructure where it needs to be. And that's things like these pipes. That's things like Michigan's roads. That's things like the schools in Detroit that are falling apart. And things like the bridge to Canada. And that's something that at the federal level, we need to reverse our spending priorities and stop spending trillions of dollars on war and start spending money keeping America, you know, safe, the infrastructure safe, in a way that we haven't done, you know, since for 15 years.
And
since the war on terror started.
And both of the candidates in Flint, the Democratic candidates, spoke to that and talked about a program to replace all of the lead pipes in the country. We're talking about some 10 million lead service pipes around the country. Marcy, before we got to get to a break shortly here, but I thought it was extraordinary to spend so much time on one issue, one sort of local. I mean, it's a local issue, but it's also a national concern. Have we ever seen a presidential debate like that held on such a specific local issue before, to your knowledge?
Not that I remember, but I think the policy issues underlying it extended well beyond Flint, and so it was a really wonderful opportunity to use Flint as a launching point to talk about larger policy issues and to raise attention on Flint.
Connor Coyne, did either of the two candidates speak to the concerns of Flint residents any better than the other as you see it? In other words, did they win anybody over in Flint specifically, you know, based on their response to the Flint crisis, at least as reflected in the debate last night?
Well, I did notice that that Anderson Cooper drew the one boo line of the night with his comment about teachers' unions. But beyond that, you know, it was very difficult for me to tell. I have a lot of friends that support both candidates. I've heard, you know, a lot of positive things and some negative things about both of them. So I don't really have a strong sense yet about how Flint's going to go. I do know that our mayor, Karen Weaver, and a number of people in her administration have endorsed Senator Clinton. So there is a sense that that the municipal government, such as it is under receivership right now, does support Clinton. But, yeah, I don't know as much about individual voters.
Marcy, did you get a sense, very quickly, did you get a sense that either Clinton or Sanders was better or worse than the other on specifically on the Flint issues? And we're going to broaden it out a little bit to other issues as well, also in Michigan. But on the Flint issue, did anybody gain or lose any ground in that debate as you saw it?
You know, I expect Hillary, I mean, demographically, Hillary, I think, would do better in Flint in any case, but I think Hillary, because she has worked with Mayor Weaver and some other local leaders, will get support from that. And to her credit, she's the, I mean, this should have been a public issue back in October. In January, she raised it and made it a presidential issue. She's the one who did that, and I think that'll give her a lot of credit.
All right, well, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with more on the Democratic debate in Flint last night. And as I said, some broader topics with my guests, Connor Coyne of Flint, Michigan, and Marcy Wheeler of Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Stay tuned.
I voted to save the auto industry. He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry.
If you are talking about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy,
you know,
excuse me, I'm talking. Let me tell my story, you tell yours.
I will.
Your story is for voting for every disastrous trade agreement and voting for corporate America. Here is the difference, not a personal difference. We just do things differently.
There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here, covering the Sunday night Democratic debate in Flint, Michigan. The first of two this week. There will be another Democratic debate this week and a Republican debate this week. So we've got plenty to cover in the days ahead. I suspect my guests today, I'm joined by Michiganders, Michigan natives, Marcy Wheeler in Grand Rapids, journalist Marcy Wheeler, and novelist and Flint dad Connor Coyne joins us from Flint, where he raises his two daughters and is contending with that lead crisis that is ongoing in Flint. Okay, they talked about more than just the Flint water crisis. They talked about other issues that concerned the entire nation. I want to get into some of those very quickly. Specifically, Hillary Clinton played this card that she hadn't played before against Bernie Sanders concerning the bailout of the auto industry. I want to play a clip from this, and then hopefully Marcy Wheeler can explain what actually happened here.
He was against the auto bailout. I voted to save the auto industry. He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry.
Oh.
I think that is a pretty big difference.
Well, if you are talking about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy.
You know.
Excuse me, I'm talking.
Let him sprung.
If you're going to talk, tell the whole story, Senator
Let
Sanders.
Me tell my story, you tell yours.
I will.
Your story is for voting for every disastrous trade agreement and voting for corporate America. Did I vote against the Wall Street bailout? I said let the billionaires themselves bail out Wall Street. Shouldn't be the middle class of this country.
Okay.
Wait a minute. But ultimately, if you look at our records, I stood up to corporate America time and time again. I led the fight against us. That is one of the major differences that we have.
Well, if I could, to set the record straight, I voted against the only multinational trade agreement that came before me when I was in the Senate. It was called CAFTA. I came out against the TPP. After it was finished, I thought it was reasonable to actually know what was in it before I opposed it. I oppose it. So when I talk about Senator Sanders being a one-issue candidate, I mean, very clearly, you have to make hard choices when you're in positions of responsibility. The two senators from Michigan said, we have to get this money released. I went with them, and I went with Barack Obama. You did not. If everybody had voted the way he did, yep. I believe the auto industry would have collapsed, taking 4 million jobs with it.
Okay, well, there was a lot wrapped up into that one clip. So, Marcy Wheeler, do you understand who supported what in this exchange? What was Hillary Clinton actually talking about when she says that Bernie Sanders opposed the bailout? Because it didn't really get adequately explained, and certainly not by CNN when this issue came up.
So there were three votes that are of consequence. The first is the vote for TARP in October of 2008, which was kind of a carte blanche for Treasury to play with $700 billion to bail out the banks. Hillary voted for it. Bernie voted against, and Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow voted against. On December 11th, the Senate was trying to pass a House bill that would have given, frankly, too little money for GM and Chrysler mm-hmm. for a bailout, and it did not pass cloture. But all three people voted for that. So Hillary, Bernie, Stabenow, all voting for a car bailout that failed. That's the only vote that was ever specifically tied to an auto bailout. In January, between the time the new Congress came in and Obama was sworn in, the Republicans tried to cut off the second half of the TARP funding, $350 billion, mm-hmm. And that would have tied to $4 billion that was already kind of promised to the car industry, but had nothing to do with the larger, the total bailout was ultimately $85 billion, so I think that's $60, $70 billion that wasn't promised yet, although it was kind of widely known that you would have needed to get money out of the TARP to bail out the car industry. But very specifically, Larry Summers wrote a letter to Congress saying, here's what we're going to do with this TARP money, and didn't mention an auto bailout at all. Zero.
And
also promised to give foreclosure relief and limits on executive compensation, neither of which promises were carried out. So Sanders voted against the continued carte blanche for Treasury. That's what he voted against doing. Most Democrats, although there were six others who didn't, mm-hmm. most Democrats voted in favor of the second tranche of the TARP dollars, and that's the vote that Hillary is talking about.
So she's basically taking
that's the money that.
So she's basically taking his vote against the Wall Street bailout and saying it was a vote against the auto industry bailout.
He voted to not give continued carte blanche to Treasury mm-hmm. for money that, in the end, did fund the auto bailout, but it was ultimately about the larger bailout and the money that was left, the greater portion of it went to.
So he's not on record as having opposed bailing out the auto industry, as Clinton seemed to categorize it last night.
He's on the record as supporting bailing out the auto industry.
Connor, do things like jobs lost due to trade agreements, as you heard him also reference in that response, does that mean anything to voters in Flint right now where you are? Do they connect those national and international policies, because we're talking about trade agreements, to the factories that are shut in Flint and so forth? Or are you guys so concerned right now with the water issue that none of those broader issues will affect voting?
Well, if you're in Flint, you're kind of juggling crises. Nobody's got the luxury of just worrying about one crisis at a time. Mm-hmm. So I would say during the 90s, it was a little bit unclear how much of the blame went to what. But I think in retrospect, a lot of people associate the automotive downsizing with the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
The Flint auto industry did lose 40,000 jobs during the 1980s. It also lost 40,000 jobs during the 1990s. And a lot of the sense, I believe, is that a great deal of that came directly from NAFTA. So no, there's definitely the larger picture of unemployment being one of our biggest issues here. And NAFTA looms very, very large in people's memory about that.
We don't have. We're running late, and I wanted to get into these this email business very, very quickly. So, Marcy, maybe you can give me. I don't even have time to play the audio here. Essentially, Anderson Cooper charged that Donald Trump is going to use the investigation of Hillary Clinton's email servers and so forth against her. And how will she respond to that in a general election? Hillary said, well, basically, I'm getting more votes than Donald Trump is. And she didn't speak to the email issue at all. I realize we're not giving this its proper due, but is the investigation into her emails, is that a real concern for Democrats thinking of voting for her as you see it, as you've looked at the issues of note in that investigation? Because Sanders supporters are repeating the same thing that Trump is, basically, that, oh, she could be indicted. So nobody follows this stuff closer than you. Is that a real thing, that the email servers? That, should that be a real concern for voters?
I think it's a much greater chance that either Huma Abedin or Jake Sullivan, both of whom forwarded Clinton material that they may have known was classified, mm-hmm. I think they're at much greater risk of legal problems.
Those are aides to Hillary Clinton, not Hillary
right.
Clinton
and
herself.
Right, and she is fiercely, to her credit and to her discredit, if the person involved is Mark Penn, she's fiercely loyal. And so the question would then be how she deals with some of her top aides getting in trouble because they may have shared classified information with her. There are other scenarios where I see that it could get closer to Hillary, but I think those are unlikely. I think it's really going to be more about how her aides may or may not be implicated.
Connor Coyne, very quickly, I got like 30 seconds here. Were you satisfied with the debate in Flint? Was there anything in particular they didn't hit you wish they would have? Or do you feel pretty good now that the national media is at least paying attention for the time being to what's going on in Flint, Michigan?
Well, I feel like as far as national attention goes, we're kind of living paycheck to paycheck in a manner. And the debate was perhaps a paycheck we didn't expect, and we're grateful for it. But these are long-term problems, and we've got to come up with a way to command focus long enough to get long-term solutions. That being said, with the exception, I wish they would have talked a little bit more about emergency management. Mm-hmm. I was happy with the attention they gave to Flint, and specifically with the way they allowed Flint residents to express their personal experiences in the questions they asked.
That is Connor Coyne. You can check him and his work out at Connor Coyne, CoYne.com. He is a writer and novelist and a stay-at-home dad from Flint, Michigan. And, of course, that was Marcy Wheeler just before that, great journalist who must be read at EmptyWheel.net and on the Twitters at EmptyWheel. Great to have both of you here with us today. Much appreciated, and hope you'll both be back with us at some time in the near future.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. My thanks also today to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and as I said, to Marcy Wheeler and Connor Coyne. If you missed any portion of today's program, check it out at bradblog.com, where you can download it for free anytime, and over at iTunes. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find and follow me on the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Until next time. Oh boy, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Yeah.